Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to have Lester Thurow here to give the 11th series of Lionel Robbins Memorial Lectures. There are many reasons for being delighted that he's here. First, I would say his extraordinary independence of mind. As you'll see, he has never followed any fashion, and he's said many. I was looking at his CV, and I discovered, which I didn't know, that he was an undergraduate at Balliol. And I thought perhaps that might explain it, because they always know better there. but then I noticed, which I also didn't know, that he did his PhD at Harvard, and of course they also know better there. So that's where he started. Most of his life, of course, he's been at MIT, where he's been Dean of the Sloan School of Management until recently, but he's continued all this time pouring out thoughts. He started, like many of the best people, as a labour economist, but he turned into an economic guru. And I think one of the most attractive features of what he does is that, unlike most economists, he dares to look into the future. It is extraordinary when you think of the purpose of economics, which is to help us to control the future, how little systematic analysis most economists do of what the future might hold. And Lester has been one of the main exceptions, and very important exceptions to this. And finally, he is a wonderful expositor, as you will see. Most Americans, of course, know him because he's a regular TV commentator and columnist, but he's also the author of many deep and important books, both about the American economy and about the state of economic science, which makes him particularly suitable to give the Lionel Robbins lectures. And we're delighted to have you here.
It's my pleasure to give the Robbins lectures, and it's my pleasure to be here. What I'd like to do is start with an anonymous Chinese quote, which I think typifies our age. We are like a big fish that has been pulled from the water and is flopping wildly to find its way back in. In such a condition, the fish never asks where the next flip or flop will bring it. It senses only that its present predicament is intolerable and something else must be tried. I think if you look at much of the world leadership in both economics and politics, you see people wildly flipping and flopping. Mr. Clinton is flipping and flopping. Mr. Major is flipping and flopping. Mr. Mitterrand is flipping and flopping. Everybody is flipping and flopping. And what I want to argue to you is basically because the stream has moved. And I want to borrow two concepts from the hard sciences to explain what's going on. One, from geology, I want to borrow the concept of plate tectonics. Plate tectonics, of course, causes the spectacular earthquakes and volcanoes, but it itself is invisible. You'll never learn what causes an earthquake or a volcano by looking at earthquakes and volcanoes. You've got to study plate tectonics. But in addition to causing those spectacular things like earthquakes and volcanoes, it also causes the everyday surface of the Earth to change what in geological time is remarkably rapidly. For example, if you go to Nanga Parbat, which is the world's biggest mountain massif at the west end of the Himalayas, it rises 2 feet every 100 years. And within a relatively short period of time, by geological time, it will be the highest mountain in the world. Now, something similar has happened in our world, and I will illustrate it tomorrow based on the United States. If you think about what drives the economic system, it's the distribution of purchasing power. And starting first in the United States and then spreading to the rest of the world, we are now experiencing the most rapid shift in the distribution of purchasing power that has ever been recorded in the United States. And it may be the most rapid shift of purchasing power that has ever happened in any country that hasn't been conquered or by an outsider or had a revolution. I'm going to talk about this in detail tomorrow and talk about why it's happening. But let me give you just two statistics to show how dramatic this is. John F. Kennedy, in his inaugural address in 1960, had a famous phrase that everybody quotes in the United States. It was, a rising tide raises all boats. And what he meant by that is if the general economic tide goes up, the per capita income goes up, most people in the United States will participate in that economic gain. They will get real wage increases. And for most of American history, and certainly in the 1960s, it was true. But starting in the early 1970s, it started to be not true. If you take our data from 1973 to 1993, and these data come with a little lag in the United States, so 93 is the last year we have, and if you look at that period of time, you will find that the per capita American GNP in real terms, after correcting for inflation, over that 20-year period of time has gone up 33%. If you then go off to look at a group of people that the U.S. Department of Labor keeps track of called non-supervisory workers, that's everybody in the United States who doesn't boss anybody else, the non-bosses of America. It's about 75 to 80% of the American workforce. And if you correct their wages for inflation, you will find that that group, the median wage of that group has fallen 20% in a 20-year period of time, relentlessly, 1% a year, almost without, with no variance. And that, I would argue, is the equivalent of Nanga Parbat. And what is a relatively short period of time, we're going to, as I will show tomorrow, dramatically change the distribution of purchasing power in the United States. And in fact, at the turn of the century, the year 2000, it is highly likely that if you look at males in the United States, their median wage rate will be lower than it was in 1950, 50 years earlier. That's never happened before in the United States. The statistics grab this audience a little harder, however, if you were an American. Let's take male college graduates in their prime earning years, 45 to 54 years of age. What do you think has happened to the real income of that group, that's us, or some of us anyway, between 1973 and 1993? Their real wage in $1990 has fallen annually from $55,000 to $42,000. And at the moment, every group of males in America at every education level, including those with graduate education, are experiencing falling real wages. And every group of women in the United States, with the exception of college-educated women, are experiencing falling real wage rates, despite the fact that we have a per capita GNP that's rising quite rapidly. And tomorrow, what I want to do is focus in on that problem as if we were Sherlock Holmes. What are the facts, and who's radically altering the distribution of purchasing power? The second concept I want to borrow from the sciences, I want to borrow from geology, it's the concept of punctuated equilibrium. Most of the time, survival of the fittest, evolution occurs very slowly. But what biologists know is that periodically in history, there are periods of time where very rapid changes occur. And what used to be a survival of the fittest species very suddenly becomes extinct. And of course, the best example is the dinosaurs. For hundreds of millions of years, they are the dominant survival fittest species on the Earth species. Then, in a very short period of time, they completely die out. Presumably, the environment changes, and they can't cope. The most recent theory on the dinosaurs is a comet hits the Earth around the Yucatan. It causes sulfuric volcanoes on the other side of the Earth, and the dinosaur dies in a dust cloud that's full of sulfur. But whatever the reason that caused the death of the dinosaurs, it wasn't evolution working at its normal slow pace. It was a period of punctuated equilibrium. I want to argue that human economics also has periods of punctuated equilibrium, and we're in them. Let me give you an example of punctuated equilibrium. Napoleon's armies roamed around Europe almost 2,000 years after Julius Caesar's armies, but they couldn't move one bit faster. They both depended on horses and carts. 50 years after Napoleon, steam trains were going 100 miles an hour. The Industrial Revolution had started, and in one century, from the 1800 basically to 1900, in the advanced parts of the world, we shift from an agricultural society that had existed for thousands of years to an industrial society that was very different, a period of punctuated equilibrium. And what I want to argue, and what I'm going to do first today, is look at the plates. Tomorrow I will look at the surface of the Earth and the surface of the earth is the distribution of purchasing power. And on Thursday, I'm going to look at the volcanoes and earthquakes that these things are causing. What I would like to argue to you is that there are five economic equivalent of the continental plates that are fundamentally changing the structure of the world we live in. And we're not in a period of marginal change, normal evolution. And so today, what I want to do is talk about those five plates. Tomorrow, we'll talk about the surface of the earth, which is the distribution of purchasing power, and how the five plates are impacting that. And then on Thursday, we will talk about some of the earthquakes and volcanoes that are coming out of that. Just to put a note ahead of time, I would argue, we'll argue, for example, on Thursday, that in the last 20 years, we've been in an inflationary prone era. In the next 20 years, we're going to be in a world of deflation, where, in fact, if anything, prices are going to be falling, not rising. And people like Alan Greenspan are basically ghostbusters. They're chasing the devil that's dead. And the interesting thing about ghosts, of course, is no human being has ever died because they've been hurt by a ghost. But lots of human beings have been killed by other human beings who think they saw ghosts. We have a famous example in Boston of five young ladies at colonial times who were executed in a town north of Boston because they were believed to be witches. They weren't witches. The witches never killed anybody, but the people who see witches kill lots of people. My five plates, which I'll talk about today, are the following. First, the end of communism or socialism. That is going to have profound effects on the one-third of humanity that lived in the old communist world. But what I want to focus on today is not the effects it's going to have on them, but the effects it's going to have on us. Because I am going to argue that that third of humanity is going to have a profound effect on the two-thirds of humanity that lived outside of the old communist world. Secondly, I want to argue that there's some shifts in technology that are going to fundamentally change the way we get, keep, and sustain competitive advantage. Third, I want to argue that there's some demography out there. And by demography, I don't mean the rate of growth of the world population that is going to be fundamentally different, never seen before in human history. Fourth, we're going to develop a genuinely global economy where you can make anything anywhere in the world, sell it anywhere else in the world, in a way in which has never been possible in the past. And my fifth plate is we will live in a world where there will be no dominant political or economic power who feels responsible for managing the system. And in that sense, it's going to be a libertarian system without a manager. Now, if you look at the actual continental plates, they, of course, float on a molten magma, the molten core of the Earth. I want to argue that our plates are basically floating on the interaction of two things. First, the change of productive forces, technology, what we might in Marxian terms call the economic substructure, and essentially ideology or the value superstructure. But what I want to argue is that those two things interact. It isn't a one-way street, the way Marx had it, where you went from the economic substructure to the value superstructure. And what I want to do is give you a couple of illustrations. Some historians have argued, and it's an interesting argument, that in some sense, if you look at technology, China had all of the technology necessary to have the Industrial Revolution 500 years before it occurred. What they didn't have was the right ideology. It isn't a world of technological determinism. Let me just give you a series of inventions which the Chinese had at least 500 years before the Industrial Revolution actually occurred. They had the blast furnace and the piston bellows, gunpowder, compass and the rudder, paper, movable type and printing. They could build suspension bridges. They had the horse collar. They could make porcelain. They had the metal plow, a mechanical rotary threshing machine, and a mechanical seeder. And if you can believe it or not, they actually knew how to drill for natural gas in shallow wells more than 500 years before the Industrial Revolution occurred. But they could never put it together. And we might say that's the Chinese, but of course it isn't. There are all kinds of examples in history of societies that have rejected technologies that later proved to be the dominant technologies. For example, in 100 BC, there was a temple in Egypt that had a steam-driven piston door that opened and closed. And the Greeks in BC had a workable steam engine. They had a toy, which was a little round ball with curved spouts that came off it. You put water in it, you put a candle under it, and it spun. That's a steam engine. But the Greeks didn't see it as an economic force and didn't use it as a steam engine. Think about the Middle Ages or the Dark Ages, where the standard of living went radically down. Technology did not disappear. Ideology changed, and that ideology led to a very dramatic reduction in the standard of income in Europe. We know the approximate standard of living of Imperial Rome, because you know how much space there was approximately per person, what kind of food they ate, how they dressed. And there's certainly in terms of city size, we know it was somewhere between 1 million and 1.5 million people. There wasn't another city in Europe of that size, and probably not another city in Europe with that standard of living until London somewhere in the 1700s, 1500 years later. Standard of living went way down, came back up, but for more than 1,000 years, the standard of living in Europe was below its previous peak. The technology was all there, but it could not be used. And so I want to argue the same things exist in our world. We're not immune to those phenomena. We don't live in a world of technological determinism. We live in a world where our values have an enormous impact on the technologies that we use or don't use. But let me analyze the plates. Plate number one, the end of communism. What this is going to do is cause a fundamental change in economic geography in the old capitalist world. There are lots of ways it's going to change it, but let's give you just two or three. Who is the world's largest producer of almost every metal you can think of? The answer was the old Soviet Union. Question is, what's happening to those metals? Well, in 1993, 1.6 million metric tons of aluminum left the old Soviet Union for the old capitalist world. And all around capitalism, people are closing down aluminum smelters. Because your smelter in Norway may be more efficient than the Russian, but he's got fully depreciated equipment, nobody capitalists that need to be paid, nothing else he can do. And what looks like a very low money-losing dollar price to the Norwegian looks like a very nice dollar price to the Russian. And in 1994, the metal of the year, with a tremendous surge into the old capitalist world, was nickel. If you go to Magnitogorsk, you will find the world's largest facility for making titanium. Because the Russians were making 3 submarines a year out of titanium. We're not even exactly sure how you do that, because titanium has to be welded in an oxygen-free environment. And at that scale, we're not sure how you get an oxygen-free environment. But each one of these submarines had in it more titanium than the United States uses in a calendar year. What used to be a very expensive, exotic military metal is now not. You can go to your local mountain climbing store and you can buy Russian-made carabiners and ice screws made out of titanium. A low, very low value-added usage for what a very short time ago was a very expensive military metal. Agriculture, a little bit of history. Who was the world's largest exporter of grain products in the 19th century? It was not the United States, it was not Canada, it was not Australia, it was not Argentina. It was Imperial Russia, the Ukraine and the area around it, because that is in fact the best place for growing grain on the face of the globe, technologically. Good rainfall, good soil, but what's really got is the perfect transportation system. Because it's full of rivers that flow south into the Black Sea, so everything can go out on cheap water transportation, and nothing has to take the lengthy, expensive rail journeys that are necessary in the other great grain producers. Now, the Ukraine doesn't have its act together, but the minute it does, what am I going to do with John Deere and Fiat, the two largest makers of farm machinery in the world? I'm going to set up a credit corporation, lend them the money to buy farm machinery, barter grain back in return, and sell it on world grain markets. And I'm going to drive grain farmers all around the world out of business. And we know exactly who they are in the United States, because we won't be immune. If you go to the 98th meridian, and if you know your American geography, about a third of North Dakota is east of the 98th meridian, two-thirds is west. Draw the 98th meridian from the Canadian border to the Gulf of Mexico, swing west to the Rocky Mountains, about 1,000 miles, and every farmer in that part of America goes out of business. The soil's worse, the rainfall's worse, and the transportation is much worse, because all the grain has to take a 1,500-mile rail journey to get it out. Every farmer in that part of America will go out of business. The threat to the French grain farmer is not America, it's Ukraine. The French will learn to eat their croissants made out of Russian wheat, or they will find 2 million Ukrainians living in Paris, and it's their only choice. Every social system does some things badly and some things well. Communism was no exception. It ran lousy economies and good schools. Russia was a high science society, hundreds of thousands of well-educated scientists and engineers. Don't you think it's going to have an impact? Let's think about college professors. The other day, Amherst College in the United States advertised a physics job. 880 people applied for one physics job, 500 of them from the old Soviet Union. What do you think Amherst College is going to do to the wages of physicists? There are a lot of American companies that are now setting up engineering groups in St. Petersburg. The big construction companies like Bechtel are all doing it. You can hire a very nice engineer in St. Petersburg for $100 a month, manage them electronically, and build your dams around the world with some very cheap engineering talent. China, 1.2 billion people, not quite a quarter of humanity, growing at 10% a year for a 15-year period of time, marching into the capitalist world. Let me ask a slightly rhetorical question, and I'll come back and talk about China on Thursday as one of the volcanoes. Suppose I gave an exam of educational qualifications to every 18-year-old in Great Britain, and then I gave that same exam to the 1.2 billion Chinese. How many people in China do you think would score above the British average? The answer, for all practical purposes, is infinity. Hundreds and hundreds of millions fall into that category. Why should I pay a British average person, whatever I pay him, let's say £15,000 a year, when I can get a better educated Chinese for a dollar a day? Don't you think that's going to have some impact? Light manufacturing is going to move to China in a big way. And with it, as we're going to see tomorrow, you're going to see some very dramatic changes in wages around the industrial world. But something else has happened. If you remember, Lord Keynes said, every businessman is the intellectual prisoner of some dead economist. In the third world, the dead economist who was Raoul Prebisch, who conquered the third world intellectually. He convinced them all that the route to economic development was import substitution plus quasi-socialism. Find out what you're importing from the developed world, set up a government-backed corporation to make that product, and develop. The problem is it didn't work anywhere. And with the combination of the success of the four countries that were export-oriented in the 1980s, Hong Kong, Singapore, Taiwan, and Korea, plus the collapse of communism in the old communist world, those attitudes have changed radically. We now have billions of people in the third world, all of whom want to play the capitalist game. That's why NAFTA exists. 20 years ago, the thing that would stop you of doing NAFTA was not the United States, but Mexico. Because Mexico believed in import substitution plus quasi-socialism, keep the gringos out. That's us. You couldn't buy property in Mexico. You couldn't run companies in Mexico. You couldn't bring American managers to Mexico. Americans were kept out of the Mexican economy. That's changed. Mexico, 90 million people, wants to play the game. And if you think of the four export-oriented third world countries in the beginning of the 80s, Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Singapore, together they have 65 million people. Indonesia alone, what, 180 million? China, 1.2 billion? India, Brazil, Mexico? You're going to see efforts to compete from the third world in the world capitalist economy that you have never seen before. There are also some interesting geography elsewhere in the world. Suppose you actually had peace in the Middle East between the Arabs and the Israelis. 60 million low-wage workers in Egypt, technology in Israel. The Palestinians are the best educated of the Arabs, wealthy consumers and investors in the Persian Gulf. Take you 10, 20 years to get it going, but it could be something interesting. And some industries can happen much faster. Take tourism. Think of a tour where you go to the Egyptian antiquities, the religious shrines of Jerusalem, the beaches of the Red Sea are magnificent, and it's the best place in the globe for doing scuba diving. You don't need too much peace in the Middle East until you're safer there than you are in Florida. Think of the Alps. You have peace in the Caucasus. The Caucasus, when it comes to skiing, are better than the Alps on all dimensions. The mountains are higher, the weather's better, the snow's deeper. And once you get on a plane, why the hell would you stop at the Alps? Go an hour farther, an hour and a half farther, and you're someplace better. Economic geography, 20 years from now, is going to be unrecognizable. Plate number one. Plate number two. I would like to argue that we're shifting from a world of classical comparative advantage that you learn about in your international trade courses into an era of man-made brain power comparative advantage. Now, if you think of classical comparative advantage, it kind of worked. Think of the United States. We grew cotton in the South because the climate was right. It was made into cloth in New England because the water power was in New England. New York City was the biggest city in America because it has the best natural seaport on the East Coast, and it has the only route for building a canal to the Midwest, the Erie Canal. Pittsburgh was the iron and steel capital because, given the iron ore, the coal, the rivers and lakes, it was the only place to do it. Chicago was the transportation capital. Texas did oil, and a little later, the state of Washington was the only place with the electricity to make aluminum. Classical comparative advantage, natural resource endowments plus capital, labor ratios, did a good job of explaining why economic activities were located where they were. I would like to read to you two lists. The first list I would like to read to you is the list of the 12 largest corporations in the United States on January 1st, 1900, not quite 100 years ago. I'm going to read the list, and then you think about what are the two common denominators of the companies on this list. They're in alphabetical order. The American Cotton Oil Company, the American Steel Company, the American Sugar Refining Company, Continental Tobacco, Federal Steel, General Electric, National Lead, Pacific Mail, People's Gas, Tennessee Coal and Iron, U.S. Leather, U.S. Rubber. 10 of the 12 companies are natural resource companies. Think about it. National Lead, one of the 12 biggest companies in America. What's the other interesting thing about the list? How many of those companies are alive today? One. General Electric, which is why people write books about General Electric. Let me read you another list. This was the list produced by the Ministry of International Trade and Industry in Japan in 1900 for their document, Vision for the Decade. And it's the list of industries that they think will be growing the fastest in the 1990s and the early 21st century. Think about this list and then compare it to the first. Microelectronics, biotechnology, the new material science industries, telecommunication, civilian aviation manufacturing, machine tools plus robotics, computers plus software. Not a natural resource industry on the list. Those industries are all brain power industries. They could be located any place on the face of the globe. They will be located those places where somebody organizes the brain power to capture them. They have no natural, God-given home. In classical comparative advantage, there basically was four ways you as an individual could get rich, a company could get rich, or a country could get rich. You could have more natural resources than your competitor. You could have more capital than your competitor. You could have better technology than your competitor. Or you could have better skills in your workforce than your competitor. What I would like to argue to you is that of those four, if you think about the 21st century, at most, one and a half of them are left. Two and a half of them have dropped out of the equation, and maybe three. Natural resources simply drop out of the equation. Natural resource prices fell 40% in real terms from 1970 to 1990. They're going to fall more than 40% in the next 20 years. A combination of the old communist world joining capitalism, plus the Green Revolution, plus the material science revolution, plus biotechnology means down in price. And unless you're Brunei, a good fraction of the world's oil and 200,000 people, nobody's going to be rich simply based on natural resources. Capital labor ratios used to make a difference. If you were born in a rich country, it was very likely you'd die in a rich country. Since you were rich, you saved more. Since you saved more, you invested more. Since you invested more, you had more machinery. Since you had more machinery, you had higher productivity. Since you had higher productivity, you had higher income, which meant you could save more, and it was a virtuous cycle. But today we have a world capital market. I, an entrepreneur in Bangkok, can build a facility that is just as capital intensive as any that can be built in Japan, Germany, or the United States, despite the fact that those countries have a per capita GNP 15 times mine. There's no such thing as a capital-rich country. Still better to be born in a rich country than a poor country. But when it comes to business investment, if I can't borrow it in the three places where everybody borrows their money, New York, London, and Tokyo, one of the firms in your country will borrow it, come to Bangkok, and set up that facility. Capital drops out of the equation along with technology and along with natural resources. Think about technology. In the last 15 years, let's think about the three products introduced into the world economy that had the largest dollar sales. Video camera and video recorder invented by Americans, fax invented by Americans, CD player invented by the Dutch. Who owns all three of those when it comes to sales, employments, and profits? The Japanese, who didn't invent any of them. Because if I can make your product cheaper than you can make your product, I'm going to take it away from you, and the fact that you invented it is going to do you remarkably little good. The only part of, we've got a new thing called the art of reverse engineering. Everybody in the globe knows how to do it. And it means the only part of technology where you can hold an edge at all is on process technologies, because you can't just go out and buy them and copy them. And so in some sense, every industry has to become the equivalent of petrochemicals, where the whole concept of a distinction between research, production, manufacturing disappears, because it's all one concept. Now, if natural resources drop out of the equation, capital drops out of the equation, technology drops out of the equation heavily, what are you left with? Skills and education of the workforce. The only way you can get and keep sustainable advantage, I will argue, in the 21st century. But the technologies that are coming along are going to radically change our business firms. There's a woman who writes on communication technologies by the name of Joanne Yates that has a very interesting new book on how communications has set the way we build the modern corporation. And to a remarkable extent, modern corporations are still built on the models of the first corporations that had to operate at different geographic locations. They were the 19th century railways. And the 19th century railways had a unique problem. It's important to remember they were invented before the telegraph. How do you coordinate something when it's the fastest thing on the face of the earth, especially when it might be on a track and run into each other? Well, the answer is you had to have a rule book, stopwatches, timetables, hierarchy, command and control. Now, how many layers do you have to have in a company? How many people can report to any other person? 30? 40? Whatever you think the number is, divide that number into, let's say, General Motors, 800,000 people, and you know the number of levels of management you have to have. But with modern electronic communication technology, that model is obsolete. You don't have to report to somebody that's geographically near you. You can skip a lot of what used to be layers to make those reports. Information can go up and down the hierarchy in very different ways. And if you think of the idea of the modern business firm being efficient by pushing decisions down the business firm, and I will make some arguments on Thursday about firms that have found that very efficient, it radically changes who you have to hire. Because it means at the bottom, you have to hire people with much better educational skills than you've ever had to hire. And we see that dramatically in the United States. If you go to the automobile industry, it used to be the big high-wage employer for high school graduates and high school dropouts. If you look at the new automobile plants that have opened, like the Mazda Ford plant at Flat Rock, Michigan, every single person they hired had at least a little bit of college education. They were not hiring for ordinary assembly line workers, because the guy at the dock, loading, unloading dock, has got a little computer. He punches in and does the inventory control, and he gives the check to the truck driver, who then takes it back to his company. And they junk the white-collar accountants. And so the guys on the shop floor have got to be able to do the accounting. Some companies are experimenting with, and we won't know what works, the virtual office. Suppose you walk into any building in London and just walk around. How many offices are empty? How many telephones aren't being used? How many computers aren't turned on? You'll find lots. Doesn't make any sense in the modern world. Very quickly, you're going to have a personal telephone number that goes with you. And the idea is that you'll walk into your company office building and you'll sit down in the first office that's empty. That's your office. key in your telephone number, call up your files on your computer. You'll have one of these flat screen things on the wall where you can put your family picture electronically, and it's your office for the day. You think I'm joking, but I'm not. Have you noticed Bill Gates' house? Bill Gates just got married. Happens to be the wealthiest American with $10 billion. The house has cost so far $30 million and is half done. But what he's done is bought the rights to some of the art in the world's greatest museums, electronic rights. The whole house is flat screen TVs. And so if he wants to push up Rembrandt, Aristotle contemplating the bust of Homer, he simply pushes the button and bango. High definition TV, it's on the wall. The technology is all there for the virtual office. Business companies are going to be different. Plate number three, demography. You've had books recently that talk about rapid population growth in the third world. It may or may not happen. The World Bank says that over the next 35 years, we're going to add about 3 billion people to the world's population, and then 2 billion of those 3 billion will occur in countries where the average wage rate is less than $2 a day. That's a Malthusian prediction. The problem is, who knows if it's right? Because I think the simple fact is, if you sit down and read the demography of population growth, is every hypothesis you can postulate, you can find a counterexample. For example, people say that modernization, urbanization, education, and wealth causes people to have smaller families. Sounds good, right? You go to the Persian Gulf, they got all of those things, and population is exploding at some of the fastest rates in the world. If you look at the adjustment that occurred in the UK that made Malthus wrong, Malthus was wrong, but it took the British about 80 years to lower their birth rate. Essentially, the whole 19th century was a period of falling British birth rates. I think the problem is, if you look at that kind of demography, we don't know. Maybe it's going to be true, maybe it isn't, but it's very hard to get your hands on it. But there are two things we know that are going to happen that are absolutely certain in demography. The first is, for the first time in human history, millions of people are going to move from poor countries to rich countries. Never happened before. In the 19th century, people moved from rich countries, Britain, Italy, Germany, to empty countries, the United States, Canada, Australia. Never have they moved from the poor to the rich. But in the 1980s, 7.9 million people moved into the United States legally, and another 3 million people moved illegally. In the rest of the industrial world, 7.3 million people moved legally, and probably another 8 million people illegally. So 10 million, 11 million people move into the United States, 15 million people move into the rest of the industrial world. It's got to have an impact. That's not trivial. And of course, what's happened is two things. First of all, in relative terms, transportation is now cheap. It's easy to move around the world. Secondly, what we have to understand is knowledge has changed. People now know what income differences are. They may even exaggerate them. I remember the first time my wife and I went to China, which must have been about 1979. My wife was assigned a young lady in Beijing who had a graduate degree in biology. This was not the sticks. And at the end of a week or two, this young lady said to my wife, she said, "I want to ask a question, and I'd appreciate it if you'd give me an honest answer." My wife said, "Well, I'll try." She said, "Is it really true that you Americans have a higher standard of living than we Chinese?" Today, every Chinese village has a satellite and a TV set. They're all watching Dallas, and they exaggerate how wealthy we are. I like to do adventures, and I spent last week in Saudi Arabia doing a camel safari across the Rubicali, the empty quarter. This is literally true. We came across a Bedou encampment 200 kilometers from the nearest road with a Honda generator and a satellite. Everybody knows, and you can't stop it. As people have pointed out recently, suppose I'm a Mexican walking into California. What are you going to do to me? Worst that's going to happen is you catch me, you put me on a bus, and you take me back to Mexico. I walk back the next night, you catch me. Suppose you put me in a California jail. People have pointed out, if you look at space per person, food per person, TV, exercise equipment, the standard of living in a California jail is higher than it is in a Mexican village. How the hell are you going to scare me with that one? You could put up the Berlin Wall in reverse and shoot me, but you're not going to do that. I'm going to come, and you're not going to stop me. The other thing that makes this migration different than the 19th century migration, of course, is people are migrating into a country that's built, countries that have built the welfare state. And we have this tremendous argument in the United States at the moment about welfare payments to migrants, illegal migrants. Because in the good old days, there wasn't any welfare, and probably in the 1950s, the small number of migrants there were didn't use welfare very much. But now the evidence in the United States is very clear. They use welfare a lot more than the native-born. In the United States, about 8% of the population is migrants. They're 10% of the welfare population, and on them, 13% of the money is spent. And of course, the problem is there's no demand for uneducated labor in these new industrial economies. That doesn't mean these aren't very talented people, but before they can be used, somebody's going to have to make the massive investments in their skills. And the question is, who's going to do that? Because it's expensive. That's not a hypothetical. That will occur. The second thing that will occur is the elderly. For the first time in human history, we're going to build up a very large class of people over the age of 65 who don't work, who depend heavily on government for their income. And the payments to them are destroying government budgets everywhere in the world, and they blow up society if you go out far enough. Let me give you the numbers for the United States, and the numbers for Europe are worse. In 1963, 23% of the federal government's budget went to the elderly. In 1993, 47% of the federal government's budget goes to the elderly. In 2003, 58% of the federal government's budget will go to the elderly. And in 2013, if nobody changes any laws, the elderly will get 100% of the American federal budget. Now, that isn't going to happen, but how do you stop it? Today, the elderly in the United States are about 13% of the total population. By 2013, they'll be 25% of the population. And the problem is we don't let people under age 18 vote. People between 18 and 13, 35 tend not to vote. This group could very well be a voting majority. And they get more than half their money from the government. And the problem is that they are completely pushing out all of the investment that societies have to do. In 1968, if you looked at the federal government budget, 35% of it went into categories that could be called investment. Today, about 12% go into categories, education, research and development, infrastructure, that could be called investment. How do you make the investments that society has to make and the things that the public has to do if everything is gobbled up by the elderly? And in some sense, the system has become the Mad Hatter. In 1970, not ancient history, the average elderly family in America had a per capita income just 60% that of the non-elderly. And you could make a welfare argument that we ought to help them, because when you came to that day you retired, your income fell 40%. Today, in the United States, the elderly have a per capita income 120% that of the non-elderly. We're taxing poor people to give money to rich people. And that doesn't even take into account special benefits, like special wrinkles in the tax law. In the United States, if you're a family earning $30,000 with one child, you'd pay $7,000 in income taxes. If you were an elderly couple getting 40% of your money from the government making $30,000, two of you as opposed to three of you, how much money do you think you'd pay in taxes to the federal government? Remember, the young couple is paying $7,855. Essentially one-tenth as much. class warfare in the 21st century is not going to be the rich against the poor, it's going to be the young against the old. And we already see it. In the United States, the school systems often have to have referendums to pass school budgets, and the elderly systematically vote against school budgets. We had this dramatic case in Calcasa, Michigan, 2 years ago, where they had a big snowstorm. They ran out of money in their snow plowing budget, so they robbed the school budget to pay for snow plowing. And then the elderly systematically voted down all the taxes to replace the money in the school budget, and they closed the schools 4 months early. And so the kids just didn't get educated for 1 year. And the problem, of course, is in our modern societies, grandparents don't live with grandchildren. And everybody can be myopic. Well, the kid I'm voting against isn't my grandchild, and somehow the guy in the other town is going to treat my grandchildren different. But of course, it isn't going to be that way. And what we've done in our budgets is we moved our budgets in the 1960s. I worked for the Lyndon Johnson's Council of Economic Advisors, and at that time we could talk about a fiscal dividend. If the federal government just did nothing, passed no new laws, and sat there for a couple years, you ran up huge surpluses. Today, you have a fiscal structural deficit. If you just sit there doing nothing, the deficit gets bigger and bigger and bigger every year. And so every year, you're either going to have to raise taxes or cut something. And the basic problem you've got as a democracy is how do you cut the income of your largest voting group, the elderly? And if you don't do it, you won't make the investments necessary to have a successful society in the future. Plate number four, the development of a global economy. Basically, with modern transportation and modern communication, you can make anything anywhere and sell it anywhere. You know, if you look at high-definition TV, it probably won't be a consumer product. Our current TVs could give us a pretty good picture for a football game, but it's an industrial product. If you go to The Limited, which is a female clothing store in the United States, production headquarters north of Boston, they have 18 factories around the world. They used to send quality control people that had to go around the world looking at the quality of the stitching. They're now all hooked up with high-definition TV, and you can see the quality of the stitching in Sri Lanka sitting in Boston. You don't have to go to Sri Lanka to see whether they're turning out a high-quality product. Now, what's happened, of course, is we have this new world economy, and the problem is there are no rules for the game, because the rules we have are for a very different game. If you look at the rules we have in the world economy, it's the Gatt-Bretton Woods system, built between 1944 and 1949, and it was built for the world that existed in 1944. Suppose I took you to Bretton Woods, New Hampshire in 1944 and sat you down and said, build me a world economy. What would you have done? Well, you would have done exactly what they did. You look around the world and say, what's reality? Well, in 1945, on the day World War II ended, 75% of the GNP of the entire world was inside the United States. As late as 1960, about 50% of the GNP of the entire world was inside the United States. So you basically built a world economy designed to swirl around this huge economic pole called the United States. And the goal of this economy was to make other economies at least almost as rich. And of course, in the 50 years after that, we succeeded beyond our wildest dreams. America doubled its per capita income in real terms, but it's now only the ninth wealthiest country in the world in terms of per capita real incomes. And instead of being 75 or 50% of the world GNP, it's 22. And we're moving from a single polar world to a multipolar world, and we have no world trading system for dealing with a multipolar world. If you look at GATT, I would argue that it's a system that exists, but there's nothing there anymore because the world has changed. What was the intellectual heart of the Gatt-Bretton Woods system? MFN, most favored nation. What that principle says is you will give every trading country in the world all the rights and privileges you give to your best trading partner. And that's exactly what nobody in the world is doing. Germany does not give to the United States the rights and privileges it gives to France. The United States does not give to Brazil the rights and privileges it gives to Mexico. If you look at the agreement that we negotiated, the Uruguay round in Geneva, signed in Marrakesh, it's empty. The IMF tells us, and the GATT's Bretton Woods people tell us, or the GATT people tell us, that that agreement will make the world economy $274 billion bigger than it otherwise would be by the year 2002, 9 years later. Now, $274 billion sounds like a lot of money to you. Say, what the hell's the denominator? That, of course, is the world GDP. What do you think that is? It's approximately $30,000 billion. $274 billion is less than a 1% increase spread over a 9-year period of time, 1/9 of 1% per year. It isn't even rounding error. There's nothing there. And the WTO, of course, is an empty box. It's an organization with nothing in it. And the rules for this trading system have to be built of a multipolar world. And the question is, how do you do it? Because the only time you can have a Bretton Woods conference is when there's a dominant world power that can sit everybody down, wrap their knuckles, and says, this is the way we're going to do it. And in fact, as if you remember your history, at Bretton Woods, there were two plans. There was the Keynes plan and the White plan. The Keynes plan was obviously the British plan. The White plan was the American plan. I don't know any economist who's ever looked at it who didn't come to the conclusion that the Keynes plan was better. Guess what we did? The White plan. Because in 1944, the United States was calling the shots. Germany and Japan weren't even there. Now, the problem is the world doesn't stop simply because you can't have a conference to write rules for the world. What I would argue, too, is that the world is moving to a world of quasi-trading blocks with managed trade between the blocks. And we see it all over the place. Quasi-trading blocks because we're not going to prohibit trade, but we're going to have freer trade within regions and more government involved in trade between regions, and you see it. Take the industry that everybody thinks is the hottest industry of the next 10 years. The industry which is the intersection of telephones, computers, media, TV. What do the French want? The French want a rule that the common market can't import more than 40% of those products from the United States. Now, 40% sounds like a lot, but American companies already sell 80%. And of course, what would happen if the common market had the 40% rule 1 minute later? Every country in the world would have the 40% rule. And I think the interesting thing is that we're reverting to an older history. If you want to watch the rules for world trade being written, go to Brussels. Because the guys at Brussels aren't writing the rules for the common market alone. They're writing the rules that will be copied by everybody else. And so, however those set of rules come out, is very important to the rest of us. And you already see it. What's every business firm trying in the world and the business firm in the world trying to get certified as? They're all trying to get certified under ISO 9000, which is a quality control standard, and you can't sell a lot of products unless you're certified ISO 9000. Where the hell did ISO 9000 come from? Continental Europe. 20 years ago, that would have come from the United States if it came from anywhere. American companies complain bitterly about having to adjust to this European standard. They sound a little bit like, if I may say so, the conservative Euroskeptics. But the fact of the matter is they both will adjust because they have no choice. The other problem you have in the world trading system could be referred to as the deer and the python problem. It's known as Japan. When we've had a transition from one world leader to another, from Britain to the United States in the 20th century, you were transferring from countries that played the game kind of alike and were willing to take some responsibilities. If you think of Japan as the second largest economy in the world, about 15% of the world GNP, the problem is it don't play the game the same way. And I think it's very important to understand that Japan is radically different than Korea or China in terms of its economies. The Koreans appreciate their trade surplus disappears. The Japanese trade surplus is even more certain than the Rock of Gibraltar. This year, the trade surplus will be $145 billion. The current account surplus will be $130 billion, despite the fact that the yen has gone to 100 yen to the dollar. No sign of it getting smaller, and it's been that order of magnitude essentially ever since the late 1970s. How do you make the world economy work? if the second largest economy in the world only sells and never buys. Because the problem, if you analyze Japan's trade, is not what it sells. The amount that it sells and what it sells is exactly what you would predict. The problem is it doesn't buy. And the place you see this most dramatically is foreign ownership of local production facilities. In the United States, 17% of the GNP is produced by foreign-owned companies. In West Germany, 24% of the GNP is produced by foreign-owned companies. I don't have the number for the UK, but I would bet it's higher than West Germany. What do you think that number is in Japan? 0.5. And half of that is IBM Japan. One company. And the problem is the Japanese don't have to have government rules and regulations to keep everybody out. And so they can say, we are the greatest free traders in the world. We have no tariffs, no quotas, nothing. And still they don't buy anything. And it isn't an American problem. It isn't a European problem. It's a world problem. They don't buy anything from the Koreans or the Taiwanese either. And the problem is, if you couldn't beat the Japanese over the head and make them change when they needed American military protection, how the hell are you going to do it when they don't? What leverage do you have to make them change in today's world? And so you have the anomaly that, in some sense, the biggest beneficiary of the system doesn't believe in the system for himself. That's a time bomb in the world economy. Because the only way it's happened for the last 10 years is the United States has basically been willing to run a trade deficit that offsets the Japanese trade surplus. And the rest of the world can run a huge deficit with Japan, a surplus with the United States, and balance their balance accounts. Because if you look at this year, where, as I mentioned, the Japanese trade surplus is 145, the current is 130, the American trade deficit is minus 168, and the current account is minus 143. But the problem is, even if you're as big as the United States, you can't do that forever. Now, we've already done it longer than any economist, including this one, ever thought possible. But it can't last forever, because eventually you go broke doing that, even if you start out very rich. My fifth plate, no dominant economic, political, or military power that says it's my responsibility to keep the world system going. You see it dramatically. Mexico. What's the United States Congress about to do? It's about to vote, we ain't going to bail out Mexico. Why should we? We're just another country. We got to look out of our own self-interest. What are the Newt Gingriches of the world? They hate. They have never seen an international organization they don't hate. They want to give no money to the United Nations, cut down on the IMF, no WTO. It's not a return to isolationism in the old sense, but it's an American firster. We're no longer the world leader, we're American firsters. And there's nobody out there to be a world leader. You see it in Bosnia. If you don't see genocide in Bosnia, you're never going to see it. And if you don't see a strategic interest in Bosnia, you're never going to see it. Bosnia is in the middle of Europe. It's between Greece and Italy. It's geographically inside the common market. If it isn't important and worth doing something about, nothing is worth doing anything about anywhere in the world. And so one of the things I think you're going to see is an enormous shift in borders. Because one of the things that everybody could agree on during the Cold War is never move a border. Because the problem was, if you moved a border, somebody's winning and somebody's losing. The Russians would be on one side, the Americans on the other, and everybody on both Russia and America thought that whoever the loser was said, you've got to come to our aid, and that meant the missiles would start flying between Moscow and Washington, and that was impossible, and therefore, never let a border move. But that game's over. We're going to see borders move everywhere. Every border in Africa is in the wrong place. It's simply at the places where the British and French armies met. It makes no sense ethnically, geographically, economically. India. Except when it's been conquered by outside invaders, the Mughals or the British, it's never been one country. Lots of languages, lots of ethnic groups. Already three countries. Little rebellions here and there. You can imagine lots of countries. North America. important to understand that Quebec, the attitudes have fundamentally changed. 20 years ago, when there was an independence movement, the basic problem in Quebec is every Quebecer in his heart wanted to be independent, but they believed that economically they couldn't survive without English-speaking Canada. Today, they know, and they're right, that as long as they're in NAFTA, they don't need English-speaking Canada. The problem, of course, is when borders start to move, you do it peacefully in places like the Czech Republic and Slovakia. They'll certainly do it peacefully if they do it in Canada, but more likely you're going to do it with small-scale warfare all around the world. Now, I think one of the other things that's made a fundamental change here is TV. Nobody likes to see their citizens killed in real time. And so you get a giant country like the United States, 1 million people in the army, every single one of them a volunteer, and we can't kill 3 of them. How do you do anything? Reading about it historically is very different than watching it. And you can't do anything unless you can prove to your citizens that your vital national interests are at stake, which isn't going to be true. Nothing threatens the United States. The Persian Gulf War, I would argue, is the last gasp of the old system. We did it because we were still thinking in oil terms. We certainly weren't defending democracy. We'll never do it again. We certainly won't do it for oil because now we've discovered that there are enormous oil deposits in the old Soviet Union, and the Persian Gulf is just not strategically, economically, the way it may have been 5 to 10 years ago. In the United States, you also have the problem, of course, that internationalism was sold as anti-communism. And if there are no communists out there, why the hell should you be an internationalist? And that's why you see the Newt Gingrichs. The problem you have is, if you look at communism, it had another great virtue. It was an ideology so powerful that people who hated each other would agree to live in the same country. Stalin, a Georgian, ruled Russia. And Stalin was, in some sense, an equal opportunity killer. Didn't make any difference what ethnic group you were in, he treated you alike. If there's no dominant power, economic power, military power of the United States, no dominant ideology, communism, whatever, what holds it together? Capitalism is a belief in a process. It's not a belief in an outcome. And what happens if the process is delivering falling real incomes for a majority of the population in a democracy? Because there is a fundamental contradiction at the heart of our democracies. Democracy says one man, one vote, egalite. Capitalism believes in inegalite. And the only way we put those together is basically with the social welfare state, which has said it is a government responsibility to make sure that the inegalite of capitalism doesn't get too far out of hand. But the social welfare state has gone bankrupt because of the elderly. There is no money in the system for egalite. And in fact, the money we're spending is going for inegalite because it goes for the rich old people. You know, Bismarck established the 65-year retirement age in 1883 when he set up the German pension system. Do you know how long the average German lived in 1883? 46 years of age. It's like our government's promising to give you a pension at 96. We wouldn't spend very much on pensions if that was the implicit promise we're making. Those are the plates. And what I would like to argue to you, and I'll continue it tomorrow and the next day, that those 5 plates together are producing a period of punctuated equilibrium, where what is the survival of the fittest company, modes of behavior, is going to suddenly radically change. And with the plates moving like that, you have the Nanga Parbat phenomenon, the 1% a year, radically changing the distribution of purchasing power, and you're going to have political earthquakes and volcanoes like you can't believe. Let's think about the American political volcano as my last comment. The Democrats in November had the biggest defeat any party has ever suffered in the United States since 1932. Think of this statistic. The United States is a big country, 260 million people. Not a single Republican governor out of 50 states incumbents lost. Not a single incumbent Republican senator out of 100 senators lost. Not a single Republican member of the House of Representatives out of 435 lost. Not one in the entire United States. Nothing like it has happened since 1932. And if you looked at the parliamentary models that the political scientists and economists like to run, where you say who's going to vote for whom based on how does the economy look and wars and all those things, the Democrats should have had a big victory. 5% growth, 1% inflation, unemployment down at 5%, and it had fallen 3 percentage points in the previous year, nobody dying and the rest of the world in a war. What the hell's going on? This is not 1932. Where prices were falling 20%, half the companies were broke, and the GNP was going downhill at 15% a year. The answer, of course, is if you looked at the election results, two huge groups voted Republican. If only women could have voted, the Democrats would have won. The Democrats got the female vote about 53 to 47. Two groups the Democrats lost: white, high school educated males. The guys who used to belong to unions, that were the heart of the Democratic Party, they voted 70-30 Republican. These are the guys whose income is down 20-30%. They're mad as hell. They don't know that Newt Gingrich has a solution to their problem. They probably know that he doesn't. But they know who they hate. The guys who built the system. That's the Democrats, Franklin Roosevelt. Because the system isn't performing. The other group that voted overwhelmingly Republican is the fundamentalist born-again Christians. Lots of times they don't vote, but they're growing very fast in numbers, and this time they voted. They don't like abortion, they don't like gays in the military, and they voted about 90-10 for the Republicans. It's important to understand that fundamentalism is growing everywhere in the world. Islamic fundamentalism, Hindu fundamentalism, Christian fundamentalism. In Algeria, they blow up foreigners, and in America, they kill abortion doctors. It's the same phenomenon. And if you say, what is fundamentalism caused by? I would argue it's a search for certainty in a fundamentally uncertain world. Because what all fundamentalist clergymen offer you is do the following 8 things or 10 things, and you will go to heaven. And they get you out of this environment that you don't like by putting you into a completely different environment where you have absolute certainty as opposed to fundamental uncertainty. Thank you very much. Do you have a few questions?
I told you to expect a great lecture, and we had one. We'll have some questions now. Who would like to go first?
I'll repeat it so everybody can hear it. The question is, why is the common market going to write the rules? I think there are two reasons. First of all, it's the biggest economy in the world. And secondly, they're in the business of writing rules. They've got to write them for the common market. And since they're writing rules and nobody else is, we're going to use the rules. You know, and it's like the thing I said on TV. The common market has now got to decide, what do you do about media imports? Nobody else in the world has to decide that question. Because some of you are very restrictive, the French, and some of you are not restrictive. So you got to make a decision. And so the need to make decisions for the internal common market leads you to be the decision-making things. Now, the important thing to understand is that if you're talking about currency values, which is what counts, 75% of the world's GNP is still in the first world. And see, the peculiar thing, you know, recently in Asia, the GNP has been shrinking because a 1% decline in Japan is bigger than a 10% growth rate in China. Because Japan is 15% of the world GNP and China's one. You don't play the game in the sense of writing the rules until you get to be very rich. And there are 3 very rich places: Japan, North America, Europe. And the only one who's in the rulemaking game is Europe. It's hard to imagine Bill Clinton making rules at the moment. Yeah. The question is about the elderly. They're a big group, but what's to stop them from retiring later?
Them. They don't want to.
Because the fact of the matter, that's a cut in their standard of living. Because it means they pay into the system longer, they work longer, and they get less because they're retired less. And it's important to understand the number of people who hit 65 and want to continue doing their work are called college professors. We have the greatest job in the world. But most people want to get out, 30 and out. 20 and out. There comes a time when you just don't want to do it anymore. And so, yes, you can easily cure the problem by saying you can't retire until you're 75, but people don't want to do that. And they've got the law that now says, let's say, 65. And they want to maintain that. And so, you know, there are obviously individuals who want to work longer, but they're allowed to do that in the United States because we have this peculiar thing where you can retire at 65. But there were only two groups of people who, until recently, could be forced to retire, and one of them no longer can. The two groups of people that could be forced to retire in the United States were executives who got pensions of more than, private pensions of more than $30,000 a year. Very small numbers. The other group was college professors, because the argument was the bastards will never retire unless you force them to retire. And therefore, you got to have a special law for college professors. Now, the courts have ruled that that special law for college professors no longer holds. And, you know, as a dean at MIT for 7 years, my big job was persuading college professors to quit. But it isn't the normal job. It isn't the normal job. College professors are a great job to retire in. Yeah. Well, the question has to do with basically the growth of Asia and regional trading groups. The basic problem to understand is there's a lot of exaggeration about the Asian economy. There's only one way to get rich: sell things to rich people. You don't get rich selling things to poor people. China is, in fact, today a small market. It's 1% of the world GNP. A 10% growth rate in China is less than a 1% growth rate in the United States in terms of total expansion of the market, and most of the Chinese are going to be consumed internally. And if you look at all the countries that have made rapid economic progress, the Taiwans, the Koreas, they've all gone through a period of time when more than 50% of their exports came to the United States. We've been the big open market for third world countries. You and Europe haven't, in general. You know the biggest import from the third world into France? Bananas. The French buy essentially nothing from the third world, and then they buy inferior bananas from ex-French colonies rather than good bananas from ex-Spanish colonies. But the problem you've got is the United States can't be the only open market for manufactured products from third world countries now that everybody in the third world wants to play the game. Nobody in the third world sells anything in Japan. They all run enormous trade deficits with Japan. Now, the problem you have on the Pacific Rim in terms of putting together a trading group, you know, in Europe was very fortunate when the common market got set up. You had four countries, 3, and then 4, all of roughly the same population, Italy, France, West Germany, and England, and their GDPs weren't all that different. And so you could kind of have, you know, equal voting rights, so to speak. What do you do in Asia? You've got one economic giant, Japan, 15% of the world GNP. You've got an economic pygmy, China, who's a political and military giant. Who gets how many votes in this new Pacific Rim trading group? Equal? You're going to give the Philippines an equal vote with 1.2 billion Chinese or 15% of the world GNP in Japan? And who's going to be the leader, the Japanese or the Chinese? The answer is there's no solution to that problem. And I think it's highly unlikely that you're going to have any kind of a formal trading group in the Pacific Rim, because it just isn't possible to put one together. And they have to trade with the developed world, because that's where the money is, the technology is, the markets are, and you can't get rich unless you trade with the developed world. And so the trading among themselves is not an option. You've got to be able to sell products to wealthy people if you want to get wealthy, which means you've got to be able to sell them in Japan, Europe, or the United States. And traditionally, for the last 30 years, the answer has been the United States. At China at the moment, almost 50% of its exports come to the United States, the PRC. I think, you know, that's very simple. It's important to understand that the people who run our societies are all fundamentally sociologically conservative. Because if they pick me to run the country, it must be the right system, right? It just has to be. It's so wise. It's picked me. And what happens, of course, if you look at these systems, is the political systems have enormous lifetimes after the reasons for them have disappeared. And I've used this example recently in the United States. Take Alan Greenspan raising interest rates. I'll talk about that on Thursday. What makes central banks important? Inflation. If there's not an enemy out there to fight, who cares who the central bankers are? They don't become important. Alan Greenspan has got to see inflation. He's not a mensch if he doesn't. John Kenneth Galbraith, in his book on the Great Crash of 1929, has a great quote. There was a guy by the name of Mellon, who was the head of the Federal Reserve Board in 1932. Prices are falling 20%. The American GNP is going downhill 15%. Unemployment is 28%. And what does Mr. Mellon say? He says the most important problem in America is fighting inflation. That's literally what he said in 1932. Now, Alan Greenspan isn't quite that extreme, but it's the same phenomenon. Take the American military. American military, and Newt Gingrich is with them, they say they need more money. For what? Where's the enemy? They had to put out a report 2 years ago saying how they were going to spend the money. They listed 6 things where you might need a big military with world capabilities. One of them was the Russian invasion of Lithuania. We lived very nicely for 80 years with the Russians running Lithuania. What's the chance that we would militarily destroy a lot of Americans to protect Lithuania, much less what's the percentage of chance the Russians would do it? They can't even invade Chechnya. It's zilch, but we still got it. And there's a big thing in the New York Times yesterday about how America needs more stealth bombers. Stealth bombers have only one purpose, to drop A-bombs on other people's cities. Who the hell are we going to drop an A-bomb on? There's nobody out there. But there's still this enormous impetus to have a big military because we've had a big military. And, you know, it will eventually end. But it's important to understand that the half-life of these sociological institutions is a much longer half-life. The world changes radically before they change. Yeah. Well, and people migrate. See, migration is the opposite of jobs.
You also mentioned that these new jobs will be intensive in education and things like that, but many of these people come from countries which are politically unstable and don't may not invest enough in education.
No, but the problem is I'm in Mexico and I come to the United States and I get welfare.
I think he's talking about the jobs moving.
Oh, well, you know, what we're going to talk about tomorrow is factor price equalization. Now, when I was taking international trade as a student in the early 1960s, when my professors of international economics taught factor price equalization, they always had a smile on their face because they could never point to a real-world example. But if you really believe that resources move around the world, capital moves around the world, technology moves around the world, then if you're uneducated, you will get a third world income even if you live in a first world country. And if you say that the social welfare system is putting all its money into the elderly so it can't do anything to invest in your skills, it doesn't have the money, the answer is you're going to sit in the United States with a third world income. And we already see that, as I'll show tomorrow. You know, one of the things you see very clearly in the United States, in some sense, it's a mistake to think of us at the moment as a first world country. We're both. We have a first world economy, and right inside it, we have a third world economy, paying wages that you don't pay in Europe because we have a much lower minimum wage and there's no enforcement, and 15 million people in the United States work below the minimum wage, and it's only a third of the average wage in the first place. And you see that third world economy being built up inside our first world economy at the moment. And of course, that's why we create jobs. They're all low wage jobs.
How do you think about the future of the WTO?
I'm sorry, the future of what?
WTO.
Oh. Yeah. Well, what the World Trade Organization is supposed to do is write the rules for the New World Order. And the New World Order is this multipolar order. But in some sense, I think it starts out with a fatal flaw. The World Trade Organization is one country, one vote. Mauritius has as many votes as the United States. Now, how are we going to write the rules for world trade in an organization of whatever it is, 180 countries, where Mauritius has as many votes as the United States, Japan, Great Britain, whatever, China? I just don't think there's any way to do it. And the only way you could do it is if there was somebody out there willing and able to wrap the knuckles, sit them down, make them agree. There isn't anybody who can do that. It's important to understand the Cold War affects the economy. The great leverage the United States had in getting other countries to do something is you needed our army. That was true in Europe, that was true in Japan, and there was a limit to how far you could let things get out of control before economic things started to become political and military things, which you couldn't afford to do. And so where the impetus to write these rules comes from, I don't know. And so I think what we're going to do is we're going to informally, implicitly write a set of rules, which, as I argued, will mostly copy the common market rules. Now, that's why, you know, if you say, where are we most likely to have a trade, the United States most likely to have a trade war, is I don't think it's with Japan. I think it's with the European common market, because this media stuff is explosive stuff. It's explosive stuff because on one side, people say it's our culture. The internet is in English. That destroys French culture. On the other hand, things like that, the internet, or some of America's biggest export is movies. It's not airplanes. We make more money from the Lion King than we do from Boeing. We can't afford to let you not watch the Lion King. Limiting them. No, it's obviously, first of all, it isn't going to work, and secondly, it isn't a good policy. Because the answer is you've got to let the people in the old communist world do something that they know how to do. And the Russians know how to do heavy industries. That's what Stalin built. And you got to let them export the things they can export. Those things, and you can't stop it. Because capitalism is very good at getting things in the back door. I mean, take Serbia. We're all supposedly embargoing it, right? Everybody who goes to Belgrade says you wouldn't know it. Well, if you can't enforce embargo on Serbia, a very small country, what's the chance that you can really stop shiploads of Russian aluminum from leaving Russia and slipping into the capitalist world somewhere? Because they don't have to slip into the United States or Great Britain. They can get into the Philippines, made into products in the Philippines, re-exported. And it happened even during the Cold War. The United States had an embargo on exports from the PRC. If you looked at linen exports from the Philippines, if every woman in the Philippines had worked 24 hours a day making linen, they couldn't possibly have made the amount of linen they were exporting to the United States. The answer is the linen went from the PRC to the Philippines and from the Philippines to the United States. And the same thing is going to happen on those mineral products from the Soviet Union. And, you know, if you look at the oil, now one of the things we don't know about the Soviet Union is communists didn't make economic decisions in our sense. How many of the existing resources, even though some of the infrastructure and facilities have been built, are non-economic in our terms? If you have to make money on them, you won't. You just shut them down. We don't know that. See, that's the big unknown in the oil business. We know there are a lot of very big deposits in the Soviet Union. The question is, what's going to be the cost of getting them out, building the infrastructure? And the key thing in the short run is secondary recovery, because you've got all of these oil fields in the Soviet Union that are exhausted in their terms, but using modern Western technology are not exhausted. And how much, and the pipelines exist for those fields. How much of that stuff can be gotten out, and how much have they ruined by poor practices so it couldn't be gotten out now, even with good Western secondary recovery techniques? But that kind of oil can hit the world market very fast. If you're talking about polar oil, you know, that's 10, 15 years into the future. But you can't afford to stop them, and I don't think you can stop them. But you're certainly right. We're trying in aluminum, and in the short run, we're succeeding. Price of aluminum went back up. We cut the exports way down. But it's a little bit like hitting a balloon. Then nickel pops up. You know, then titanium pops up. How much of that? And it gets to be harder because when an American company starts to own the aluminum mill in this old Soviet Union, then you're just, you know, then you're stopping your own companies from selling it into your own markets, not from the Russians selling it.
Last question.
Yeah.
Okay, I would like to return to your argument that capitalism is no longer a comparative advantage. If you're in a project in Europe or in America, you would probably work with the cost of capital around 10%. If you're on a project in, let's say, Malaysia or Indonesia, you would work with around 35%. That's the cost of capital. Now, indicating that capitalists are extremely reluctant to migrate.
Well, I understand some of the articles that make the argument you say, but see, I think your fundamental first premise is wrong. What's the internal rate of return demanded at Johnson & Johnson? 35%. Every American company I know uses a hurdle rate somewhere above 20%. Now, see, I think that's one of the mysteries, and I think you can even make an argument that big corporate world companies do it wrong. They all use these enormously high internal hurdle rates that have almost nothing to do with market interest rates. Why do you get this huge gap? It's not a topic to answer here, but it just isn't right that Western business firms are using low interest rates while, let's say, Asian business firms are using high interest rates, because the answer is Western business firms, when they make these investment decisions, are using very high interest rates too.
Well, thank you very much, Lester. This has been a fantastic start. You have two more laps to go. We look forward to seeing all of you here again at 5:30 tomorrow. And let's thank Lester for a wonderful evening.